Hi, this is Ken McCarthy of Jazz on the Tube, and as you know, this year we've become Cuba crazy after our 10-day trip to Cuba with Ned Sublett, and we had an amazing encounter this spring, or where are we? No, I'm sorry, this fall. Ned sent out a note saying there's a great band playing at Birdland, you got to see it, so we went on down, and in fact, there was a great band at Birdland. It's called Makeke, and it is made up of young Cuban musicians who are fantastic, and it's led by Jane Bennett. And we had an opportunity to meet Jane and her partner, Larry Kramer. They're on the phone with us today, and we're going to talk about a bunch of things. First of all, the tour that Makeke is on. Do not miss it. I've been to 3 shows. I wanted to go to 4, but I missed one, but I'm going to go to more shows. That's how good this band is. They have a new album out called Odara, and they have spent a lot of time in Cuba. And we people of the United States look at them in envy because they're from Canada, which means they can just get on the plane anytime they want to and fly to Cuba and do whatever they want, which we haven't been able to do for 55 plus years. So they quite wisely have been going down to Cuba since 1982. And they have connections within connections within connections. And they're going to talk about their adventures down there over the decades. And we're going to talk about this amazing band that Jane has assembled and anything else that comes to mind. So welcome, Larry. Welcome, Jane.
Hello.
Hello. Great to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the call. We have a lot of U.S. listeners. We have listeners all over the world, but most of our listeners are from the United States. And, you know, we're all curious about this great island and the amazing music that comes out of it. And like I said earlier, we're a little envious of you that you've been able to go down there. Let me ask Larry first. Larry, how did you guys start going to Cuba in 1982?
Well, let me explain it very simply. First of all, we love Jazz on the Tube. I've been a subscriber for quite a while. And I noticed your recent fascination with Cuba, and I've loved it. We've been a friend of Ned Sublett's for many years. And so it was nice to make that connection with you. Yeah, 1982, we were just young pups, and I had quite a travel bug. I had traveled through South America when I was young, and I was looking for something, I don't know what, at the time, and we used to go to Mexico. You know, up in Canada, we have Toronto, a lot of last-minute trips, you know, where you pick up something for, you know, $1.99, a last-minute trip to somewhere warm, and I used to go to Mexico from time to time, and when Jane and I started dating at university, I said, let's go, you know, let's go to Mexico, and unfortunately, she got quite ill from the water, you know, kind of a sickness that I don't think that happens anymore, but it happened regularly. You know, you get some kind of bug from the water. And so she said, oh, I can't go. And so we saw this place, Cuba. Cuba, that's weird. What's the story on that? And this was just when they were starting tourism. And so we decided to go on a trip. And it was in Santiago de Cuba, which was the eastern part of Cuba. Now, there was very little tourism at that time, but in Santiago de Cuba, there was almost nothing. There was one place, and it was the opening of this resort. And at that time, no tourism. I mean, they thought we were Russian. People would look at us. It was that foreign, you know. Rusa, Rusa, Rusa. And so that was it. And that's why we ended up going, because Jane, and I to a lesser extent, but Jane really got a bad bug from the water in Mexico, so.
So, Jane, your stomach is the source of your career in Cuba.
My travel. I'm led by my stomach.
By the way,
yeah, no matter how careful I was in Mexico, I just kept picking things up from, I guess, the bacteria. And a friend of mine said her family and she had gone to Cuba and didn't have any problems with the water. So we said, what the heck? And there was an ad there, very low price, 1 week, all 3 meals a day, your flight, and transfers, you know, 300 and something. I said, what the heck? You know, there's not chancing anything here. Let's go. And that was pretty much it. From the moment we got there, it was just music everywhere. We were just, you know, that it was just instantaneous attraction to the place.
Well, you know, I kind of failed to introduce you both properly. We're talking with two musicians here. Jane, it's Juno, right? The Juno Award?
Yes, we've won 5 Junos and had 2 Grammy nominations.
Yeah, so, and Jane, you're a flautist and a soprano saxophone player?
Mm-hmm.
And Larry, you're a trumpet player?
Correct.
Yeah, so, now, were you already professional musicians then?
Yeah, our careers weren't totally established, but we were out there on the scene honing our skills, whatever you call it, doing little gigs. And we did our first recording in 1987, which was more of a modern jazz recording with Dewey Redman, the late Dewey Redman, and the late Don Pullen. And, yeah, but we were, you know, we had been going to Cuba quite a bit during, you know, going back and forth prior to making that recording. In fact, there was a little bit of some inflection, some inspiration from having gone to Cuba on that recording, but it was pretty much a modern jazz recording that we did, our first one. Yeah.
Gotcha. And you're both from Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're both born and bred in Toronto, which is pretty rare here. It's kind of like New York, the fact that so many of the people and musicians are not from here. So
gravitate to the big city.
Sure, and Toronto is probably the main jazz scene. I know Montreal's got a good one, but it's probably the center of the jazz scene in Canada now.
Toronto really is, yeah. It has quite a history, and it's growing all the time. There's a lot of great venues and a lot of great concerts and the jazz festival, of course, and yeah, it's really quite an amazing city right now. Plus, we have a jazz radio station 24/7.
And there's three universities that have jazz programs, so that I think too. Yeah.
Great. So now you're establishing your careers, and I would say doing an album with Don. I know this guy, and can't remember
the late Don Pullen, the pianist that was with Mingus for quite a few years.
Sure, Don Pullen, but also Dewey Redman.
Yeah.
I was good friends with Ornette Coleman I met him when probably the year you guys went to Cuba. I had been already working with Ornette for a couple of years.
After we finish this, we'll interview you.
I have stories.
I like to hear about that.
So I would say that to have Dewey Redman and Don Pullen on your first album, you're definitely established. And when did you start becoming really focused on the opportunities in Cuba musically? Jane or Larry?
I'll let you go first, Larry, and then I can add in.
Well, the thing that happened, it was one of these, you know, the first day we arrived in 1982, we connected with the music in a very quick way. We went out to this resort about an hour and a half, and as I mentioned before, it was a brand new resort. And as soon as we got off the bus, there was a guy playing the Cornetta China. Speaking of Dewey Redman, Dewey played a similar instrument. I think he called it the Chennai, which is an Indian version of that same instrument. But the Cornetta China means a Chinese trumpet. You know, it's a double reed, shrill instrument. You know, the instrument Dewey played sometimes?
Yep.
In Cuban music, this is used in the conga, specific to Santiago de Cuba, and it relates to the call and response music. The voices, you can hear this high-pitched Cornetta China, Chinese trumpet, over everything, all the drums and voices. So it leads, like it would go, yeah, 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 and then the voices go, da, 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 da. And so the first time we were there, the first day, somebody was playing that. We said, wow, what's this? And then we get to the resort, and there's more people on the bandstand than there are in the audience, including us. And one of the first musicians that we met, and we actually played with the first day in Cuba, was a friend for all those years we've been there. And he just died recently. His name is Paisan Millet, remarkable trumpet player and educator. And that first day, he remembers the first song we played and our reaction, and we always joked about that and remembered that on our travels. And that was, it was a quick hit right then, and it was sort of like, we got to get back here. And then after the second time in the Oriente province, Santiago de Cuba, we started to hear different sounds, really dense sounds from Havana. It was salsa, but it was really dense and sophisticated music. We said, where does this come from? Everyone says, oh, that's Havana. So then we said we had to get to Havana, which we did, I guess, probably by 83 even.
Yeah.
And then maybe you can take over, Jane. What happened when we got to Havana?
Well, when we got to Havana, we went armed with sort of a handful of names of people that we should look up that were, you know, sort of the great known names in Havana. And I guess one of the first was Bobby Carcasses, who's still a very good friend of ours, who ran a jazz club called Club Maxine's. He's kind of a Renaissance artist in the sense of, like, totally. He's a painter, a visual artist. He's a dancer. He was an Olympic athlete. He plays flugelhorn and trumpet. He's a singer. He plays congas. He plays piano. He does it all, and he's a real showman.
Bobby Carcasses is in his mid-70s or later now, and recently he's been on two. He supports a lot of young players. A lot of players have come through his group.
Art Blakey.
It was great to see him recently. He's been on two records. That he was on Arturo O'Farrell's Latin Grammy winning record that just won the Latin Grammy, and he was on Wynton's album that he did in Cuba, so it was nice to see that respect. But Bobby ran this club, and he invited us, and all the musicians came out to this little hole-in-the-wall club in Havana.
Yeah, so we went there and hung out with Bobby, and then a couple of other names that we had been told to meet. The first one was Guillermo Barreto. And so we went to meet Guillermo, and it had turned out that Guillermo was married to the foremost interpreter of Afro-Cuban music, Mercedes Valdez. So Mercedes not only performed the religious music, but also was a popular singer, too. And Guillermo, the reason we were directed towards Guillermo was because Guillermo was a great jazz drummer in sort of the style of Joe Jones. He was just crazy for swing music and for American jazz. He'd opened up a lot of racial barriers by being, when Nat King Cole and certain performers were in Cuba prior to the revolution, they demanded that Guillermo was the drummer of choice, no matter what the racial, you know, thing was going down the line. So he was on the scene with so many of the great jazz people, and so he was eager to meet us. So we roared over to meet Guillermo, and Guillermo spoke pretty good English and just loved to, you know, talk about Dizzy and Charlie Parker and just all the greats. And those two were really the two pivotal people that really, really started the momentum for our very frequent visits to Cuba, because they started to introduce us to all kinds of Cuban music, you know, all the different styles that they knew. And you couldn't have been probably two of the most important people in the music that directed us.
You put Frank Emilio into the mix. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He ended up playing with at the Lincoln Center. He was a blind pianist who was really... Their heyday was in the 50s when they started the Cuban jam sessions. They called Descargas.
Along with Chacao Lopez.
Yeah, Chacao, Catawine, all those guys. And they did these after their gigs. These guys would work. I mean, the 50s were a crazy time there for musicians. And they would end up doing these jam session recordings.
Well, they were the folks, Los Amigos, that developed the Descarga. That became so popular.
Descarga means a jam session, the Cuban jam session that was closely related to jazz. So we connected, as Jane mentioned. Guillermo, the drummer, was like our Cuban musical father, and his wife, Mercedes, was like our mother and teacher in terms of the Afro-Cuban music. And they were a couple to be connected with.
Yeah, they took us under their wing, really.
And so at some point, we got the idea, wouldn't it be amazing? Because you couldn't do it. Nobody did collaborations then. So we thought, wouldn't this be an amazing thing if we could do this recording? And so we had, more than anything, we had time there and creative energy. And so whenever we got a chance, we'd go and hang out with them. And we'd plan this dream project that we never thought could happen. And then after a while, we started to legitimize it. And they went to the Cuban government, and that took a couple of years to try and plan that. And then the CBC in Canada got interested in it. And so that's... To make it a long, long story short, we ended up doing a co-production between Canada and Cuba.
With a couple of years of red tape to cut through. Like one of the groups that we recorded with, who had just recently started working with Mercedes Valdez, was a group called Yoruba and Dabo, which are pretty big right now in terms of being one of the founding groups that play rumba. And they were all registered, that group was all registered as dock workers, because that's the heritage of that music. It was performed down in the port. And so they were all registered as dock workers and weren't even allowed to go into a recording studio. And we weren't allowed to go into a recording studio either, because we were foreigners. So So all these things had to be okayed by the Cuban government.
Wow.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting, Ken, though. Something that I've really thought about a lot is that when we were coming up, the music we loved, I mean, we loved a lot of the music of the late 50s and 60s, sort of a lot of the Pharoah Saunders, Coltrane, that kind of cutting-edge music that was happening and in those years. And we, of course, went back and studied the masters and became very close to the music of Byrd and Dizzy and, you know, that history. But when we were young, that music really hit us. And an interesting thing that happened, the connection between jazz and Cuban music has always been very close until one time. And that was after the revolution in Cuba. But at the same time the revolution happened in Cuba, there was a revolution in jazz that happened.
Right.
With Ornette, speaking
sure.
of Ornette earlier.
Yep,
Ornette
59.
And what Coltrane was doing, Pharoah Saunders, African-influenced music, that happened right at the time that Cuba was cut off from the U.S. So that was a pretty interesting time, because if you thought of Coltrane went to Cuba in the 60s when he was doing Africa Brass and Kula Se Mama, a lot of these interesting African-influenced recordings. I mean, it would have been natural to work with a lot of these folkloric groups. A lot of the, you know, Yoruba and Dabo, we mentioned a lot of these Afro-Cuban groups would have been a natural for that. But that whole era was missed. And then so when we connected with the music, that's what we were looking for. We were looking for that.
So that had been our reference, and that had been, I think, what initially really intrigued us about the music was hearing that connection, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We connected with a lot of those folkloric groups. So, and those guys didn't work with jazz musicians very rarely, and you know they were that was music of the streets and of the ports, and it was
well having
music.
Horns like none of those guys had horns, like it was just drums and drummers and singers and then maybe a couple of dancers. So when they all of a sudden saw a horn player jumping in the mix, it was kind of intriguing for them.
And then also harmonically, those guys would play alone and it never worked when Cubans are very strict when it comes to orchestration, and so they'd write music for these groups, but these groups would never be in tune. But the thing that we learned by working with them is that you let them do their thing and then you work around that, and that's where we had some great success with that, and now it's used. If you hear so much modern Cuban jazz music, you'll see that. Well, you know, Pedro Martinez is a big star now, the great percussionist who we work with, and many people are using the Afro-Cuban religious music within the jazz context. It's a natural now. It really goes together beautifully.
But it's so interesting. You're absolutely right that, you know, the revolution was in 59, and Ornette hit in 59. And there was this divergence for all those years where the connection between American jazz and Cuban music was just completely severed.
I know, it was unbelievable what was happening then. I mean, you know, a lot of it was music that didn't last, obviously. You know, a lot of the avant-garde, you know, a certain percent of it was unbelievably fantastic, but there was a lot that it was just a tumultuous time, really, for the music and for a lot of things.
Sure, and a lot of exploration. Well, I can see why when you showed up in the 80s that the guys that had been around on the jazz scene must have been really happy to see you, because from what you're saying, it sounds like there was a complete drought of musical visitors to Cuba.
Yes.
Wow, that's
very
hard
little.
To imagine.
That's a good way of putting it.
They'd have the odd person from maybe Eastern Europe come in, and there'd be the odd American thing that would happen. I think I know that David Amram came and did something that was quite sort of a jam session, something in the 80s, maybe it was even the late 70s, but it was really, really cut off, and nobody, you know, none of the info on Cuban music really got out to anybody. I mean, I didn't know about it. Like when we, to be very honest, we, with our studies of jazz, you know, from our late teens into our 20s, when we went to Cuba, you know, we weren't fans of Latin jazz. I worked in a record store when I was 16, and, you know, and I found Latin jazz, really, most of the stuff that I would discover was very commercial, and it didn't move me.
Mm-hmm.
And until, you know, going to Cuba, it was like, whoa, what is this music? This isn't like anything I've heard. So it was everybody was cut off from the Cuban scene, and, you know, in New York, they had their own thing happening, and, you know, L.A., that was sort of more commercial. Latin-oriented music, and the real heart and soul of what was Cuban music was really hidden except for a few people.
Well, I know the leaders of sort of the salsa movement in New York City in the 70s were all pretty much young, very, very young guys that were self-taught and really kind of figured it out on their own.
Right.
You know, they didn't have a connection to any older music because that Cuban input was severed. It was gone. Wow. Boy,
a lot of the people, when the Cubans started to get into the scene, the people got, you know, like you mentioned, a lot of the people were self-taught. So a lot of these Cuban musicians that came in later and studied, and it was sort of like, whoa, we don't want to know about these guys. What is it? You know, it's a very funny scene, you know.
Right. And let's maybe talk about that a little bit, which is the level of musicianship and the thoroughness of the training, even if it's not, quote, formal university training. Just can you speak to that a little bit? The culture, the musical culture of Cuba, because that's the thing that rocked me when I was down there.
Well, one of the things is that they spend so, you know, they really, that Malcolm Gladwell line that they 10,000 hours. I mean, even a lot of the unschooled musicians are playing all the time, if it's religious ceremonies, if it's, you know, just down at the Roombas and the, like, social, you know, on Saturday afternoons. There's just so much time and focus put on the musical activity for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really only been in the last 20 years that it started to be of interest to tourists, you know, to be investigating that. But that was the thing that most surprised me was, outside of even the school musicians, that just the amount of music making that's happening. And then you look at Cuba's got 25 conservatories over the whole country, and then five of them are in Havana. Each province has, you know, a middle school and an upper school for, like, a conservatory, and that can be up to, like, you know, 200 kids maybe in one of the schools. Most of the people do gravitate towards Havana because that's where the superior school, which is called ISA, is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you basically have, if somebody is entered into a music program, and these students, they audition all over, you know, their various province. So if somebody lives, let's say, out, you know, in the countryside in Camagüey, which is one of the cities and provinces, they will come in, you know, it might be an hour trip, you know, into town to audition to enter into the primary music program there. And if they get in, they will have, like, a good, you know, 10 years of musical training and then go on to one of the upper-level schools, and a lot of them being in Havana. So that's an amazing amount of training. You know, you're looking at somebody who's at the age of, you know, in their 20s, and they've had, like, quite a few years of musical training under their belt.
Mm.
So they're really, you know, formed professional musicians when they leave the conservatory, if they decide to teach, if they decide to perform whatever, you know, musical activity. So those things are just so impressive because it's very, very focused. And the one thing that I do think is changing a little bit, unfortunately, but something that Larry and I witnessed a lot was the dedication of the teachers, in that the teachers really almost become like a family member to a
mm-hmm.
lot of these musical students. They really, really take their students under their wing and work with them for a number of years, and it's quite a beautiful connection to sort of see how that happens. Unfortunately, what's starting to happen and has been happening in the last few years is that a lot of the teachers are leaving because it's too difficult, you know. They might travel a couple hours to teach in a conservatory.
Well, if they're lucky enough to have a car, maybe they wouldn't get enough to even buy the gas to get to the classes. You know, that's
right.
How rough it's getting, so, you know. But that's a whole other story. The system is really under pressure.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we did. I don't know if you're aware that we started, when we started to have great success with our adventures in Cuba, we we started to...
That was 1995. We started the music program.
We call it Spirit of Music, where we worked in a different conservatory every year. We'd take some repair people down. We'd raise the money, do a couple gigs up here, and we'd raise money. We'd take some donated instruments. We'd take a couple repair people, which was really the amazing thing. We'd take repair people that would volunteer to come down, and we would repair instruments. We would set up in one of the conservatories, Havana, Camagüey, Santiago de Cuba. We'd set up a little workshop. They'd have their tools, all the parts, and then we'd be bringing Jamie Ebersole books and music things that we'd do working with the students that were interested in the jazz world, and their instruments would be repaired. There's some good scenes of that in the movie. The National Film Board did a documentary called Spirits of Havana. It's actually available free online, National Film Board, nfb.ca or .com. And we really got to know a lot of the young kids at the schools. Now many of them are pretty famous professionals, but you really get to see how the system works and the dedication of the teachers and the students. And to get into these schools is really quite a... We were there a few times when there's lineups for audition day, and the parents are just, you know, praying their kids can get into these schools, because it's not just getting into the school, it's a life. They can often live at the school, and the meals are provided there, and you're just covered, you know, with music 24 hours a day when you get to go to one of these schools. So we got to tie that into our whole lives. The music, interesting thing in Cuba is that it tied the education with the home life and with the street music. You know, a lot of we're talking about the rumba, that's the music of the street. That now all ties in together, you know.
I wanted to ask a question, which is your group of doing that support work still active?
It hasn't been for a few years, but last time we did it was Santiago de Cuba. But yes, we will. We still often arrange for instrument and, you know, bass strings and reeds and things like that to be distributed, but we haven't done it for quite a few years, the program, because a lot of the schools have changed. It's a lot more difficult to be involved in the schools, and plus there's a lot more
paperwork,
people that are taking things down, and I think, yeah, a lot of Americans now are hip to that and are taking down instruments, and I think that's really helping the situation on the basic level.
Well, let me ask you this. For any of our listeners that might be going to Cuba might be interested, if they are going to Cuba and they want to bring some stuff, what are the kinds of things that are in short supply or that people really need down there, that musicians really need?
Well, reeds, you know, saxophone reeds, clarinet reeds, bass strings, guitar strings, nylon and steel, drum heads. Yeah, pretty much everything.
But often we often get bass players who give us used strings, and they just eat them up down there, because acoustic bass players will change their strings quite regularly, and those are just great for Cuban students and even some professionals that don't have access to these things. Even things like valve oil. I mean, I always grab a few
valve oil,
slide oil for trombones, but reeds for horns. Those little things, mouthpieces. I always grab a few. You know, if you're going down, you know, and you can just meet the musicians and, you know, distribute them among people that you meet, and it really helps.
Great. I know there's a group called Horns to Havana that's based in New York, and they work with
Susan Sillins, Larry.
Oh, great.
Yeah, that's Susan Sillins' group. Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing good. They actually opened a permanent repair shop in Havana recently, and trained a bunch of people down there to repair instruments. So,
well, that's great. We've got to check that out.
Yeah, that's great.
We're going to Havana in the 29th of December, so we'll have to pop in. Maybe
you
can send a link to
them. I'm going to see them in New Orleans in January. They're going to be part of the GEN.
The GEN program, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they bring Cuban musicians, kids, up to the city. They brought a bunch up in the spring, and they're bringing a bunch of them to this New Orleans thing. So I'll make sure to mention you to them, because, wow, yeah, you should definitely be in touch with each other.
That's great.
So you made this film. So maybe we could talk about that, the film that you made, or possibly, actually, you know what? Let's talk about, if you can remember, where we were before I interrupted you and asked about the supplies. I think you were talking about the street musicians.
Yeah, it was just the thing I was relating to is that we, the way we connected the higher end, all those areas of areas in Cuban music from the, we got involved with the conservatories, and then the street musicians, which we don't call them street musicians, but the musicians who play the rumba, which is the spiritual music, drums and voices, you know, that all really connects on the street in Cuba. And, you know, we used to rehearse, the way we put it together was one of our great collaborators, Hilario Duran. He's a great pianist. He's lived in Toronto for quite a few years. He was originally with Arturo Sandoval's group, and he's, you know, in the line of great Cuban pianists with Chucho Valdez. And so we would put those pieces together. We'd write music, and we'd hang out at one of the rumberos' homes, and he'd bring his piano, and we'd have a bass player. So we'd hear the music they did and where they rehearsed, and we'd make our connections and do the arrangements and do it all there. But the many things that would happen in the music, you know, sometimes little kids would be, like almost babies would come over when the drums were playing. We'd go, wow, where's this kid from? He's always like four doors down. And we'd say, what, he's here by himself? He said, oh, yeah. His mom knows whenever he hears some... here's the music that everything's cool, you know. It was that kind of culture where music is just through everything, and music is means kids are safe. Music is really is in the core of everyone's being in Cuba, and it's right on the street. You know, it's just in people's homes. You know, you just walk. You know, it's that's the kind of experience that we had with music and still do when we go there.
Yeah, they're pretty eager to share. Yeah,
and they're great collaborators as well. That's why what keeps bringing us back, no matter how crazy things are, we're always back because somebody has a new project or we have an idea that's connected with people, and we just keep finding ways to get back there.
Speaking of collaboration, you know, we've talked about the conservatory world, which is very well put together, and then you have the, I don't know, it's you're right, it's not street music, it's music that doesn't come from the conservatory but is every bit as serious, but it's just coming from a different place.
Mm-hmm. Well put, yeah.
Yeah, and it's the music from Africa, through the cane fields, through the sugar mills, through the docks, you know, the rumba music, for example. So those are very well established. Where does jazz fit in? Now, I know jazz was big and freewheeling in the 50s. I also know that, you know, the new government, when it came in, wasn't so sure about jazz, and that jazz, my understanding is to learn jazz in Cuba, you have to go out of your way to learn it. Like, it's not like they're making it easy. There's no institutional.
No, absolutely. You're totally right. I mean, I think jazz is in between the two, both of those musics. And, you know, I often wonder if jazz wasn't America's original art form, let's say if it had developed in Europe, Cuba would have been more accepting to it. I don't know. You know, it was just mm-hmm. basically because it was imperialistic and it was banned. And so there's still very much that stigma now, even though, you know, there is a jazz festival and even though there's such an interest and a natural affinity to play jazz, Cubans just, you know, they do have it. Even though the feel's a little different, they still have that desire to want to be able to swing and, you know, move in that way. But it is, you know, there's still a very protectionistic ideology that's over the Cuban music, because it's not only just the Cuban composers, the very early composers, but a very much a focus on Eastern European. So, you know, Tchaikovsky and Chopin and all of that music is there. They're very, very serious, and they don't like to mix that stuff all up.
Well, back in the early days, I mean, people like, the Paquitos, when they went to the institutions, Amadeo Rodan is one of the biggest, you know, jazz was banned. You know, you couldn't be playing in the practice room. You know, that, of course, changed. Yeah, and that was loosened up. And so, but even now, they do not teach jazz in any of the conservatories. They teach, you know, strict, incredibly disciplined, more so Eastern European, but as well as the Cuban music. I mean, the amazing thing is that all of these people study drums. They all know rhythm, which is totally the opposite of North America.
But I think, Larry, I mean, we're not totally specialists on this, like somebody like Annette Sublett is, but I think, like, in the schools, the drumming was basically focused on military-style drumming and, you know, classical style. Like there was no, in the, you know, up, only up until just a few years ago, there was no Afro-Cuban music style. They didn't learn Afro. They had to go. They had to go to the folkloric musicians. If there's a young drummer and he's in the conservatory and he's interested in learning Afro-Cuban style, he's got to go right to the source, and it would be to the rumberos. And that's why I think those guys are still so highly respected.
But also, it's the same with jazz, Kim. It's that they do that on their off time. But as Jane mentioned, they have such a natural affinity for it that they, you know, they're so hungry for everything. You know, it's not like they pack up their books, go home and watch Oprah, you know, or Dr. Phil.
Right.
I mean, they go from the class to the jam session to the studies to the salsa band to there's just a constant energy of you know, because that's what's going on, right? There's not a lot going on, right? There's not a lot of things to have, but music is one that is in everything, and it's out there. It's for you to have and to
be part
of. Well,
it's got the possibility for fun, for interaction, and also travel, which is still an incentive, I think.
And in spite of the obstacles, there is a jazz scene in Havana. One of the things that we do on Jazz on the Tube is we actually run, we're the only source in the world, even in Cuba, of the listings, the jazz club listings week by week. We have a friend in Havana who goes around and gathers them, and it's quite difficult even in Havana to figure out who's playing
where.
You're
telling me. It changes every night, you know? I mean, you know, you've got to be there. You need a guy on the ground, Cam. That's great.
Yeah, tell your friends.
I hope he gives you updates every 24 hours.
Well, yeah, we get the weekly, and then it probably changes a lot, but at least we have a base to work with.
Oh,
yeah, if anybody goes to Jazz on the Tube at our Cuban tab and they click on our Cuban tab, one of them is, I don't know what it says, calendar or jazz calendar. If you click on it, we've got what's playing at all the different places. So in spite of the obstacles, there is a jazz scene, and there are places to go to hear jazz. And we didn't hear a lot of jazz when we were with Ned because we were focusing largely on the folkloric stuff because that's what's so unique down there. But we heard a bunch of jazz, and it was really good. I want to say something about folkloric. Like it's an unfortunate word because to me it makes me think of someone doing a square dance or something.
Yeah.
You know, and these guys are deep. Like I don't think, you know, we have to call them something. We have to give them some label. But if anybody's never heard what we're talking about, it is not square dancing. It's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's not hillbilly music. It is some.
No, it's very intense Afrocentric. Polyrhythmic, incredibly, but it's right now. It's right now. You know, it's not. When we were first looking for that music, it was very hard to find because they had sort of, it's Rumba Sunday somewhere, and it would be kind of like touristy, you know. But when you find the real, it's a growing, it was a living in the 80s, 70s. It was.
Well, also,
really,
but also, too, you have to remember that it was divided, too. There's the, you know, one side is religious. What's for religious ceremonies, and then the others more so for social activity. So,
right,
that's partly why it was hard to find. If you witness it, it might be more so a commercialized sort of social setup, and then a lot of the religious ceremonies, you would only really be able to go to that unless you knew somebody who was, you know, celebrating.
But it was a living, breathing, moving music that was of the street, and you could always find it somewhere. And it's great to see, you know, it started the late 80s. It really rose up. It was a little hidden until the late 80s and then the 90s, and now it's really quite strong.
And as you mentioned, it's kind of fluid. Somebody might be playing drums in a religious setting, then they might be playing in a social rumba setting, then they might be playing in a jazz setting. The same guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderland, and I tell everybody, you know, you got to go to New Orleans. You have to spend some time in New Orleans and see that scene because it's completely unique. And if you love music, you must somehow get to Havana and Santiago de Cuba. And there I haven't been, but I'm actually hoping to go this winter if I can swing it. Let's talk now about the present, and the present is a group called Makeke.
Yeah.
And Jane, you are the leader of that group and are the person who put it together. And I would love for you to talk about why this particular group of musicians, what was in your mind when you put this together, how you put the group together, you know, all that would be wonderful. And of course, you have a new album out called Odara, mm-hmm. which I have a copy of and I love. And again, I've seen this band 3 times now. Every time it was fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's one of those bands that you can see over and over again and get new stuff from it every time. So first, how's the band put together and how did it get together?
Okay, that's a real good question. Well, I have to say that it was really Larry who pointed it out to me.
Before I let Jane take it over, maybe I'll just say that my joke is, you know, we just did this as a project, and I'll explain and let Jane take over with the details. But I realized that when I produced the recordings, and I didn't realize that I'd be producing myself out of a gig.
Yeah.
But you know what? I have no regrets. I'm only incredibly pleased because this group has taken a life of its own. And I know that since you've seen the band 3 times, it's sort of magical what's happened. And it came out of Jane and I realizing that, you know, working with the conservatories, that there's so many great young musicians, young women musicians, that kind of took a back seat. And it was one of those things where timing and everything was right. So it happened. I'll just give the beginnings of the story and let Jane take over. But we go on this event. There's a jazz station, Jazz 91, Jazz FM here in Toronto, that's supported a good percentage by donors. And they take these things called jazz safaris, which they take donors on different trips. And this is the first year they decided to go. They go to Monterey Jazz Festival. They just came back from England. They took us to Panama with them. And so they said, you know, let's do this in Cuba to the jazz festival. So we were invited along on that. And the last night of the event, we were at the Melia Hotel. I think you've seen that right on the Malecon, the Melia Cohiba Hotel. It's right next to the Riviera. If you've seen that, right, Ken?
Yep, and I know where it is. It's downtown. It's a little.
The last night in the cigar bar, we decided to put on a party for all the donors, and we said we'll invite some of our favorite musicians to this jam session and party.
Cuban musicians,
and so a young lady came up, and I'll let Jane take it over.
Yeah.
From here.
So in the lobby, I met this young woman in the lobby named Dimey Arosena. At the time, she was just 17, turning 18, and I said I was, you know, doing a jam session and invited her to join us, to come into it. And she said, sure. Anyway, she came in, and she was really, really, really good. You know, she just sang well beyond her years. She's just so seasoned, I guess was the word. And everyone, of course, in the audience was, you know, really impressed, and who is that, and me too. And afterwards, when I returned to Toronto, I'm artistic director of a show every year that's called Sistering, which raises monies for women at risk, if they're women, you know, in crisis. And so it's like sort of, oh, how do you say it? It offers accommodation and food and, you know, just the necessary housing for sort of interim, you know, risk that's happening in a woman's life. And so a lot of new immigrants and the whole thing. So anyhow, I managed to convince them to allow me to put her in the show, because usually with the band that I have, I back, you know, 4 or 5 singers. And I said, this would be really great because, you know, there's a lot of now Spanish-speaking, you know, young women in the city, and it would be great to have her. So we brought her, and so this was just a few months after I met her, and she brought the house down. She was, you know, she was up there with a bunch of very well-known singers in Canada, and everybody was so impressed with her. So right then and there, Larry said, you know, maybe you should try and do something with Dimey. We've never done anything for any of the women. I said, yeah, you're right. You know, like for a good 25, 30 years, we've been slugging away with our group Spirits of Havana. And many, many musicians have come through Spirits of Havana, starting with Pedrito Martinez. He played with me for 4 or 5 years, maybe longer. Daphne Prieto, Hilario Duran, David Varelles, Erwan Artes played with us. Carlitos de Puerto play with it. There's a big long list. they've all gone on to amazing careers and are leading their own groups and are all over the world. And we had never, I'd always been the only woman in Spirits of Havana. So my time was sort of taken up, you know, with all the stuff you have to do, the visas and the travel and all, you know, everything. And but we thought, well, Larry said, well, maybe now's the time. And I thought back, you know, that's right. You know, I'm always, when I'm at these jam sessions and out on the scene, I'm just so often either not seeing even the young girls that I'm meeting at the sessions. If I do see them, they're sitting on the sidelines, just happy to be in the audience. And often they either hang up their instrument or they might, if they're lucky, teach. But I was not seeing anybody out on the scene. And I just thought, okay, this is, he's right. Maybe this is the time to try and inform something. And what the heck, let's give it a go. So we went down to Cuba and we sort of talent searched out these particular women, because I knew, both Larry and I knew, that we needed a certain kind of personality for this group. I mean, we've had a standard. We have a reputation with our work. We had, you know, received 4 Junos for our work and a number of awards and stuff. And so it really had to be, it had to be perfect. It couldn't be any less than, you know, what it could be. But everybody, you know, when we did decide on the members, everybody was at very different levels. 4 of the musicians were classical studies. And yeah, that's just the best way to describe it. They were all at various levels. But so we went down, we picked out the musicians we wanted. We then went into a studio. Then we went into a place. We started rehearsing at Dime's. Father runs a funny club, which is kind of like a drag queen club. It's sort of in a hole in the wall. It's a little taboo, but not totally. And so he managed this club. And so we started rehearsing in there, and it was pretty rough. Often we'd just go in there, and there'd be no electricity or lights, and be sitting there in the dark. But we managed to, you know, work on the material. I wrote a bunch of tunes, and Dimey wrote a couple things. And we sort of workshopped the stuff, and then we went into the studio. And we went into one studio, and the piano broke, and then we had to move to another studio, and something else went wrong. But we managed to make this record over the course of about a month. And we came back with the tapes, and I was really beside myself. I was like, I didn't think the record was very good. You know, it was like kind of a departure from what we've been doing. I felt like it was all over the map, but Larry kept saying, and he produced it, he kept saying, you know what? I know it's a rough stone, but there's stuff here, and we're going to polish it up. It's going to be great, and we just need to work and fine-tune things. And that's what we did, and the record ended up getting a Juno. And
nice.
It was just it was really shocking, because it went into the best jazz group recording. And anyway, after that, I put, you know, sort of some feelers out to see if we could do a tour in Canada, because I'd done that a number of times. So we have sort of these organized festivals across the country that happen over about 10 days. And everybody was very eager to have the group. They knew our reputation with the Cuban music, and this seemed like a great idea. So we did our first tour, and then we did a petition to go into the west coast of California, sort of promoting that record, which was called Makeke. And so we did a California tour that would have been 2014 into a bit of 15, and then brought them back again 2016 to do a little tiny bit of touring. And by this point, the group, we had really started to spend some time together. When, you know, when we came to Canada, everybody lived here in the house, so we would rehearse together, eat together, and really form kind of an old school band kind of concept,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing really started to take shape, and it was pretty, you know, pretty impressive. And now with our second recording, the group has just gone from, you know, a whole other level than what it was at, because number one, we've spent time with each other as a group. We know each other personally, you know, pretty well, whereas when we did that first record, it really was just a leap of faith, I call it. It was just, let's just try this and see what happens. No idea, you know, that it would take shape the way it did. And the response has just been phenomenal. And now, from what happened with the first record to now, everybody for the new record all wrote tunes. Not everything made it onto the record. We didn't, you know, we have an overabundance of tunes. And we'll see what happens with the third record. You know, I don't know if some of that stuff may go on to the third record or if we'll morph into, you know, something even better or different. Who knows? But the thing is now the group is really moving, developing very quickly as we're getting better performance opportunities and really developing a pretty great audience for our work. So that's the story of McKeke.
It's great, and I'd like to talk about some of the individual musicians, but first I'd like to talk a little bit about something that we were speaking about before the recording started, which is the situation for women musicians in Cuba, and you already alluded to it a little bit, but maybe you can get into it a little more depth. You know, up here, there's certainly opportunities for women to be professional musicians, and in jazz, it's become a lot more accepted now. Women instrumentalists, that's relatively new, right? I mean,
it is. I mean, it's probably a good 25 years now that it started to be norm, I think.
Well, I would say it's just been the last 10 years, really, since it's been, you know, really blossoming, you know, in terms of a lot
leadership.
Of young, a lot of
so
young women, you know, horn players, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's blossomed, I think, in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And so it's taken a lot of time, even here in modern progressive North America and Europe, to get to that point. Now, Cuba has a different culture, and for people, you know, brief history of Cuba is Cuba was the last island to stop slavery in the Western Hemisphere, and they were, the business there was sugarcane growing, and that was a man's work, and it was very brutal, and pretty much the economics that they thought was acceptable was to just work people to death and then get a new batch from Africa. Mm-hmm. That's really how it works. So it's a very, especially out in the countryside, it's a very male energy place culturally. And the history has a lot to do with that. But of course there's phenomenal talent among the women. So, but you were mentioning earlier that currently at this moment in Cuba, it's pretty much a man's business. And the women kind of stay on the sidelines. There's really not much of a way for them to get in professionally. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so. I think it's hard because even for the guys, you know, even for the guys to get out there and get a gig, it's not easy for them. And because you've got, you know, you've got to go through government permission. You can't just go to a bar down the street and say, I want to perform, you know, speak to the guy that runs the bar. He's got to go speak to somebody. You've got to either, you know, apply through an agency or some sort of, you know, some sort of government organization to get permission to do it. And then when you do that, then you've got to, you know, get your transportation. Then you've got to, you know, to get your instruments there, if you even do have the instruments. There's just all these layers of just problem after problem, and it's just not an easy thing, and so much of, you know, the club thing there is geared to dancing and, of course, like any other place, selling drinks, getting the tourists in there, and what everybody wants to do is dance their asses off, right? And so
right.
that doesn't always work for jazz.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a very niche, it's like any place in the world, it's a niche market, and there is a love for it, but it's more so, you know, it's just niche, and then you've got to go through all the layers of government, and it's tough for the guy, so if any woman wants to get in there, you better get in line, you know?
Right, so
the most experienced of talking about the individual players is the drummer in McKeke, Yissi Garcia, she's probably one of the few young women that runs her own band. It's called Bandancha. It's really a powerful group of
guys.
Yeah, of guys. And her dad was a very famous drummer, Bernardo, and he played with Arturo Sandoval in many different groups. But Jane tells a story of how, you know, she has a brother who they wanted him to be the drummer, and she was going to be the ballet dancer, but it the tables were turned because he's a dancer and she's a drummer. Huh. But she's one of the few women that, you know, does lead her own band that's not a singer, a vocalist. And so that tied, you know, so once we were putting Makeke together, she was a, you know, a very important part of the band.
Yeah.
And if it's not, by the way, if it's not clear, I may not have made it clear, this is an all, this band is made up entirely of women.
Yeah, in their early 20s, yeah.
Another idea that time had come, you know, there's a bit of a point to it. Why do you put a band of all women together? Well, why not, you know? So when the time is there, that the time is now, and often when, you know, we've had, the personnel has changed it from time to time, but it always keeps the same magical energy, and I think, you know, there's a certain female energy that is different, you know, it's a different kind of, there's a joy to seeing the group, I think you've seen that, and I get to see it regularly. There's a joy and there's a sharing that is very fresh and individual. I mean, it's very...
Well, they love playing.
Different. Yeah.
They don't take it for granted. So.
Yeah, so that joy you see of making music, and there's no holds barred either. So it's a beautiful thing.
And that's one of the things that I really like about... One of the many things I like about the group is, you know, not only are you giving opportunities to Cuban musicians to perform both in Cuba and outside Cuba and see the world, but also young musicians. And because we're always saying at Jazz in the Tube, you know, what are we doing for our young musicians? You know, if we want jazz, you know, they're always saying keep jazz alive. Well, the only way to keep jazz alive is to make sure there are new musicians coming up. And they need.
Well, I think it was
work.
Yeah. Well, and we got to, you know, we were helped by the masters of not only, I mean, in jazz music, we mentioned Dewey and Don Pullen and many of the mentors that we had. You know, I got to play with Eddie Cleanhead Vincent and Slim Gaylord and some of these great masters, and we both had studied with Barry Harris, and we always looked to the elders when we were young, and then we got to record with Dewey and Don Pullen and Billy Hart and so many of these incredible musicians, Sheila Jordan, as we mentioned. And so I guess it kind of, you realized, wow, all of a sudden, you're a veteran. They're calling you first they're saying, oh, from an exciting new voice on soprano sax, Jane Bennett. And then you
okay.
And then an article says, you're a veteran.
Hang up the phone, Larry.
But you realize why people like Blakey and people did play with young musicians, because it keeps you inspired. And that's what's happening exactly with Makeke. It's the constant...
Although watching that Buddy Rich thing last night on the... Yeah, I don't know about that. We were watching some Buddy Rich stuff with Buddy Rich chewing everybody out in his big band.
No, but also Buddy Rich on Mike Douglas' show. You got to see that clip where he talks about country music, but we are diverting from the reality here.
It's interesting that you mentioned Art Blakey, because we just stumbled on a clip of him, an interview in 1965. Yeah, it's great. We're going to post it soon, where he talked about what he was trying to do. And he said, we're trying to create leaders. We're trying to create stars. We're trying to, you know, because here's what he said. He said, when I played in the big bands, he didn't get any exposure. He didn't lead to anything. So he was consciously trying to put together a vehicle. Yeah, he was consciously trying to put together a vehicle where new musicians would come in, get their chops together, and go out and become stars.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was a
yeah, but now, but now the problem is, do people really want to do that in sort of an instant culture, right? I mean, that happened then, and then the Young Lions movement came along where people were instant stars,
right?
And then that kind of died, and now are people... I mean, we all look at how great Joey Alexander is, but is he going to get the opportunity to play with an Art Blakey, with those, you know?
Exactly. He's already being, yeah, he's not getting a chance to develop sort of behind, not behind the scenes, but off camera, you know, every
yeah.
Yeah, to play with those kind of masters. I mean, he's a special example, but those bands, the Art Blakey, it's very hard to have those kind of bands. I mean, there's also no Six Nights a Week. I mean, we get to play at Chicago. Luckily, Chicago Showcase, which is one of the few places that has, you know, a longer night run outside of New York, you know.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I find this band, Makeke, so important. You know, again, not only giving Cuban musicians an opportunity and young Cuban musicians, but young women, because there's not a vehicle for them yet.
No.
And it's, you know, it's half the world, you know, and it's, yeah. you can, when you see the band, you realize, wow, I mean, this band's as good as it gets. And you don't, even in the States, we don't really see all women jazz units.
It's almost a novelty in some ways. I mean, a lot of great people have done, Terry Lynn Carrington has done some great things in that area and different levels. But, you know, in Cuba, for example, it's been a novelty thing, and that's what we're breaking out of too. And I think, you know, that, I think Jane is still trying to fight, I think in some quarters, it's still, oh, well, it's all women band. Until you see the band, right, you think it's
not
still
gonna
that
be any
kind
good.
Of prejudice. Oh, it's going to be novelty in some sense,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that's still something we're fighting with. That, I think it's still sexist on that level that people, you know. But we're breaking the boundaries with that. I mean, that's why
we're out
three weeks with the band. And it's paying off, I think. You know, we're starting to do a lot more venues. Chicago Jazz Festival next year, we mentioned we're out of your neck of the woods. Saratoga Jazz Festival. We're doing the Washington, D.C. Jazz Festival. Be back at the Jazz Showcase in Chicago. We're at the Miami City Jazz Festival in February and Wichita. Friends University, and you know, I think we're really going to
just getting the exposure.
Yeah, we're just getting the word out on the band, so
thank you for
helping spread it.
Oh yeah, well, you know, if you're not exposed to it, you can't break down that bias. You know, once you see the band, you're like, wow, this is just a great band, and then it makes you think about, wow, how many great women musicians are there out there that aren't getting a chance to find a place to play? So yeah, I think you're. I mean, I know you're doing something very, very significant here. So you mentioned the drummer who comes from a great musical family, and she's so good that didn't a rock band borrow her for a while from you?
She still is doing that, and we missed her on a gig, part of our tour at Regatta Bar.
Two dates.
She's with the legendary Dave Matthews, who just loves her playing. She hasn't replaced his drummer. he's still with the band, but. She connected with him in Cuba and loves it, and just love. He loves her playing.
Yeah, he says she plays like Jesus.
And Jane said,
Did you know he played Jesus? Did you know he played drums?
I didn't know he played drums.
Jesus played drums. Anyway, she's getting a lot of. She's actually working with him again in Mexico, and she played at Lincoln Center with him as part of a big program, and also at the Kennedy Center just recently. And he loves her playing . And we just hope that we can keep her. But, you know, a funny thing that happens is that when you do a band like this, people come out, you know, people appear, you know, because they feel the energy. And we found a young woman. This is really an interesting, only in Toronto story. The woman that replaced her was a young woman named Sarah Thar. And she lives in Toronto. And her roots are, she's born in Toronto, but her parents are from Tanzania. And they're Indian, so she's got this Bollywood African thing happening, and she studied with one of the great musicians, Cuban musicians. That's how we heard about her, and he said, "Oh, she's my best student." And then she found out about the band and came to some rehearsals, and she filled in and did an unbelievable job. So
and now the girls love her, so they're pretty happy that we have somebody. When Yissey gets stolen by some rocker. We got Sarah, hopefully.
That's great.
So, and there was another drummer, actually in Akron, who studies with Billy Hart at Oberlin College.
Oh.
And she's going to Cuba and studying. Her name is Alina Kahn, and she sat in with us in Akron at a wonderful little place called Blue Jazz. So people come out of the woodwork, you know, they find, and it gives them the energy and the courage and say, wow, this is something I can do. And that's what we're hoping to develop.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Yeah, you're showing something that's possible that people may not have realized was possible before. And yeah, it's going to inspire a lot of people, give people confidence to step forward who might not have otherwise. Hey,
no, we hope people, you know, from all areas come and, you know, if they hear about the group, they can call. I think that's what happened with Blakey. I mean, someone like Freddie Hubbard came from Indianapolis, I think, right, originally. And then they hear about Blakey and they get involved and Blakey hears about them. And I think it would be nice to continue the group with that spirit of Art Blakey, but for young women, musicians.
Exactly. Exactly. What a great model. I'll send you that link so you can hear him talking about it. It's, he was very clear about what he was doing and why, and he certainly accomplished it. Now, speaking, you have another drummer from Santiago de Cuba who plays congas and...
That's Magdalie Savanier, yes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
She's from Santiago de Cuba, and she's quite a force.
Yeah, she plays all the percussion. She plays marimba. She's very, very good.
And she's very well studied. She's amazed people, you know, and a lot of people have discovered her through the band. And she lives in Toronto now, and different people are, you know, she's very popular here now. And Danilo Perez, for the Pan American Games, he did a big commission that Jane was part of. And Danilo just loved her playing, you know, and tried to steal her from the band and didn't work, but...
Not yet.
This goes on a lot.
Maybe Jane can talk a bit about her. She's very talented,
very, very good singer, and she's now composing for the group. And, yeah, she's just marvelous, yeah. Brian Blade was playing on that show, and John Patitucci, and they just thought she was marvelous.
But also, she has... you know, she has the schooling, so she could read, but also, you know, this talent of her singing. Nobody realized she sang, and she does the lead on, when I, just knowing about her history, I thought the song, the Leon Russell song that we do on Odara, A Song for You, I just heard her singing that for some reason, even though she wasn't singing too much with the band, and she just does a beautiful version of that, and she's doing a lot more vocals with the band as well.
Great, and then you have a violinist.
Elizabeth Rodriguez, yeah, she jumped in a pinch, had been doing some work with Melvis Santa, and Melvis had a conflict when we had the four nights at the Chicago's Jazz Showcase, and I needed to get somebody very quickly that could sing really well. I didn't know how great she played violin, but I needed to, you know.
Well,
anyhow.
The interesting thing about her, Ken, is that she, months ago, she had... It ended up, she grew up, she was a kid, a friend with Yissey when they were kids.
Oh.
And actually, she was living in Toronto. We didn't even know that. And she was a classical, she played with some of the great orchestras in Cuba. And
classical violin.
She connected with us months when we were really busy, just saying she loved what we were doing and she loved to be.
And I was like, oh, I don't have time to connect with some classical violinist, blah, 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 until I found this out that I didn't have, you know, I needed somebody to fill in because you had to have six people on stage in the contract. So quickly I got in touch with her because she's a Facebook friend, and I said, do you sing? And besides playing violin, she said, yeah, I can sing. And then when she came over,
Facebook, that was one advantage of Facebook. It said, you know, because we're, you know, classical world is very different than in Cuba even. But so it said on her profile, religion, it said Yoruba, so I said, oh, you got the gig. But she came over and hung out a bit, and then she went to, I didn't make this trip to Chicago, and she did the Jazz Showcase with Jane, and
everybody just loved her.
It just connected.
Yeah.
Her name is Elizabeth Rodriguez, and she's really grown into the group as a violinist and vocalist.
And then there's Dana Olano, who is from Havana. She was, believe it or not, the girls, I didn't know this till like last year when the girls told us that when they were little that she was on TV, on television, she was like a child star. She had a hit singing this song called Suki Suki, which was a true story. She wrote it and sang it. Somebody stole her dog. Her dog ran out the door, and she never saw the dog again. So this was a really sad song called Suki
Suki. Oh, my God.
And so she was all over national television in Cuba.
When she was 6 or 7 years old.
But later became, you know, has been studying for, you know, a good 20 years, been playing piano since she was a baby, and graduated from ESA, and just last year came in second and all over Cuba in the classical piano competition. So she is like an unbelievable classical pianist and has been sort of talent scouted by a couple of universities in the U.S. to enter their piano studies program. But, you know, all they'll cover, of course, is the scholarship. They can't cover rent and everything else that needs to be covered. But anyway, so when she started playing with me, she, you know, her jazz chops were so-so. I mean, she could play pretty good Cuban tumbao, which is that repeated dance and stuff. But her improvising was really, you know, not so great, really not very good. But just what's happened in 3 years, it's just like night and day. She's just phenomenal and just has just developed so quickly. She's really, really talented and is writing, you know, a lot of compositions. And then our last member of the group is Cecilia Jimenez, who actually is a classical bassoonist. And just last year, she and Dana played a Mozart piano concerto, and they sort of got to know each other just a little bit because Celia was playing classical bassoon in the symphony, and Celia's only been playing the bass just a few years. She saw somebody playing it at school and sort of was curious about it and sort of, you know, picked it up and plucked a few notes on it and said, I kind of like this. And later, you know, started borrowing basses. In fact, the bass that she recorded on in the first CD was not her own bass. It was somebody else's broken bass. And she now has her own bass, but I wish she had had it then, but she didn't.
Her development has been outrageous, too.
Yeah.
I mean, really funky grooves, got her own thing. And she has, and I think three of the girls in the band have perfect pitch, which is really weird in a band.
Yeah.
You know, that's really
And she's from
freaky.
Kansas. She's from she's about an hour and a half from Havana.
Which is the great sort of Athens of Cuba, they used to call it, because so many great musicians came out of Matanzas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a very distinct. I think Perez Prado was from Matanzas, too, believe it or not.
Hmm. Yeah, and that phenomenal Rumba band that I can...
Muñequitos de Matanzas, yeah.
Exactly.
They're in the film. We recorded with them in our film. You haven't seen our film. It's called Spirits of Havana.
No, I found it on YouTube. I found clips of it, and we'll put it on
the
page.
Yeah, but you can find it on the National Film Board site, the whole film. It's for free. National Film Board.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it's great. It really gives you the picture of what it's like to be in Cuba and traveling around and going from place to place.
Yeah, that was the year 1999, 2000, so that's quite a while ago.
Wow.
Different time.
was that in the middle of the what do they call it, the difficult period?
The special period?
Well, that was later in the period. The special period started around 91, 92.
Okay.
And we did our record. Speaking of Ned, you know, Ned was around in those early days. That's why we love Ned so much. When we were kind of scouting, Ned would always show up. And he actually,
yeah, he would. That's true.
You know, Robert Palmer, the great writer,
yep.
He wrote the original notes for our Spirits of Havana recording in 91.
Wow, okay.
And we wanted Ned, you know, we just released it this year, the 25th anniversary, and Ned wrote an update as well. You have to get that. It's a 2-CD set. And Ned wrote some notes for that just this year. He wrote some minor notes for that. So
and that album, is the Spirits album?
Yeah. It's Spirits of Havana and Chamalongo, the 2 CDs we did together, and we found 2 unreleased tracks that we put on that. And then the original notes are there, but we also wrote some new notes, and Ned wrote an update to those notes on that.
Oh, great.
You
know what? If you shoot us your address, we might be able to get that sent to you.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah. Just email us that or text it.
Yeah. Let's to wrap it up a little bit, let's talk about people visiting who want to visit Cuba. You know, people are always asking me now about things, and I'd say, well, look, it's a Latin American country, so if you've been in Latin America, you'll be at home. It's a country that has a lot of economic challenges, obviously, and a lot of infrastructure challenges. People are wonderful. There's lots of music, but you need to be patient. You know, it's not Zurich. You know, it's not Switzerland. It's not even New York. You know, you just have to, you know, roll with the infrastructure challenges, and that has not changed since your early days there. And I hope someday they do get an opportunity. I hope our crazy embargo comes to an end, but that's not so certain at this point. But people just need to be patient and know that the riches are there. Do you have any advice you can give to people that are going down there to visit on how to find music or just tips?
Well, I would suggest, first of all, is like all the things you said about patience, but try to connect with people. Find, and, you know, not hustlers. There's hustlers everywhere in the world, and I think there'll be more and more. But if you can find people to connect with, you won't go wrong. And, you know, stay with people. You know, go to a place like, get out of Havana and get to Santiago de Cuba, Camagüey, Matanzas, and stay in people's homes. And that's how you really connect with people and music. If you're interested in film, art, culture, anything, dancing, you'll find that through people, you know. and you'll meet other people through, you know, by staying with people and meeting people that way. That's how you'll really connect with the culture.
And people, they have a network of guest houses that are
exactly
government.
Again, you have to be careful. People are always on the street saying, "Oh, you want a room? You want cigar? You want a room? You want meals?" And people are hustling, but you can find people
deciphering.
Yeah,
I think is the word.
It's I'll give people one hint. If somebody tells you they need money to buy powdered milk
is another one.
But you find people, if people want are hustling you too much, they're not the right people to hang out with generally.
Right.
You find, I mean, I tell people that meet, you know, I mean, many people meet people of the opposite sex. I know that's not a taboo. Unfortunately, people fall in love and they think, oh, why? Why am I 60 years old, bald and fat, and these all these young women love me?
Yeah.
And I'm of both sexes, but I'm saying for people, I mean, you can go to a library and meet amazing people there. You know, the level of education, and you meet people that are truly into culture. So, I mean, just spend the time to develop and meet people. There's so many real people that you can meet, and you can walk into an art gallery and just walk into this world. It's like Alice in Wonderland, and you can meet people. So you have to spend the time and meet people. And that's where you'll, you know, and often by, as I mentioned before, by staying in people's homes, you can really get to know people and the culture and connect that way.
And those are called casa populares.
Sorry, what was that?
What, there's a technical term for the guest house.
Oh, casa particular means like a private house. Casa particular. And the restaurants are called paladars, which are privately run.
So
yeah,
Casa
Particular is the whole network now. I think they're even, you can find them on the internet too. I think Airbnb
is
the Cuba section
there. Yeah.
And they're government certified, and you know, you can be confident if something's
But it's still when you're outside of Havana, you can just find them you just talk to people and you can check out places, and you know, when you arrive,
they often have like a little blue triangle above the house.
Right.
But you're smart to always maybe just look on, you know, wherever you are, just look on the internet, and if you see something, you know, just register, like look at the street and just see, like for example, if you were in Camagüey and you're on Calle 52 in San Juan, then check out that one in Camagüey and just
be patient,
read about
and
it.
Find
yeah.
the right place, because also the food is great. You know, often these places you pay a little extra for breakfast and dinner, and they make great Cuban food.
They know how to cook. Everybody knows how to cook.
And
there.
That's the way to go. You know,
yeah.
That's the way to go, because you're with a family. You tell them what you love, and often you find the guy who owns a house as a university professor, and his wife is maybe a music teacher, or they have a brother who's a pharmacist, and they have somebody who's, you know, whatever you're interested in, you can find the people.
I would say, though, any internet research you're going to do, you need to do before you arrive in Cuba. You know, you need to arrive in
Cuba.
Yeah,
you're better too, but you can always go into a hotel lobby too and use their, you know,
yeah, it's pretty slow, but it's, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then to pick up on something you said, this is a very, I mean, not everyone, of course, but there are a lot of highly educated, highly cultured people in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
It may be a higher percentage than in North America. You know, I mean, there's a lot. And so just be aware of that. This is a very, it's not like other parts of Latin America where education is not accessible or it's only for the people from wealthy families. This is
Well, the interesting thing, Ken, is that you find a lot of people, and this is a double-edged sword for them, but overly educated people with time on their hands. So that's to our benefits in this busy world. You find people that are hyper-educated and they have time. They're willing to share their time with you because it's just, you know, not a lot.
Yeah. So you kind of have to blaze your own trail down there. But I think if you go and you're smart about it and do a little preliminary research and are respectful, and also just be aware that the riches are there.
You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah,
be
that's
patient. Be patient, but you know, look around and meet spend the time to meet people, because when you do, it's like another world opens up for you. It's just marvelous.
And I think that's a good point. Cuba is another world. It's not just another island out there. It's a whole world unto itself. And, you know, because of its unique history, a lot of things have been preserved there that you really can't find anywhere else on the planet. And it's a little bit like New Orleans in that way. I mean, New Orleans has certainly changed a lot, but, you know, until they built that interstate highway to New Orleans in the 50s, New Orleans was an island, basically, in the Gulf of Mexico. That,
right.
You know, you were either there or you weren't there, and if you were there, you really didn't leave. So it had its own very deep culture that was held on to a lot of great stuff.
Well, it's interesting, though, how long it took for so many. I mean, you never hear about New Orleans musicians, I mean, other than traditional musicians until, you know, Wynton came along. And then, I mean, you know, there was Ed Blackwell was from New Orleans, Vernell Fournier, a few cats that you heard of. But since then, look at the last 20 years of all the musicians coming out of New Orleans. I mean, it's just, you know, and it's a parallel to Cuba in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So the group again is Makeke,
mm-hmm.
which, based on my extensive knowledge of Yoruba, means the spirit of a young woman.
Yes.
Well, that's how the name came up. You know, we were thinking of a name. We were trying to come up with it. And we asked, you know, the young vocalist, Daimi Aracena, who Jane mentioned. Her mother is deeply into the religion, as a practitioner in the religion. So we asked her to come up with some names, and she named a few and gave us the meanings. And Makeke was the one that...
Well,
really...
no, Larry, I didn't even see the meanings. I just saw, like, five names. And I looked down and I said, what does this one mean? And then, because I just liked the sound of Dara. It was just strong. And she said, fiery energy and spirit of
Makeke.
A girl.
Makeke? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Makeke. Yeah. Fiery, yeah. Makeke. There it was. And it was just like, this is strong. What does it mean? It sounds good. Yeah. And
cool. And,
yeah,
and so that's the name of the band. And the name of the latest album is Odara. Does that have a meaning?
Yes, it does. It means... happy, strength, and fine, everything good.
That came from our first album. It was sort of our hit tune called Yo Siempre Odara. That was a song, means forever. Yo Siempre means I'm always, and Odara, it means strong and happy, and that comes from, like, everything's good. It comes from the Yoruban, and that's a song that Guillermo Barreto written that really symbolized the music that we were doing on our first recording, Spirits of Havana. You know, he said, we're not going to do something. We're going to do something that's timeless, that covers the whole history of Cuban music, but also the future. And he came up with this.
That was dedicated
tune.
To me.
Yeah, Yo Siempre Odara.
Oh,
Odara,
nice.
Forever Stronger. He wrote that for Jane. And that's the
wow.
So we
and
actually,
I try and live up to it.
Yep.
That's a big thing to live up to.
It is a big thing to live up to.
You know, I don't know.
Especially when you see me in the morning.
I don't know if this is an African saying or a Cuban saying, but... It goes like this: if you know your ancestors, you'll live forever. You know, in other words, if you're connected to all the music and people and culture that's come before you, you'll live forever. You know, it's sort of a metaphysical idea, but I think there's a lot of truth there. So I love that name.
Sure is.
It really describes the group, because the group is definitely happy. They're clearly having a great time while they're playing. They are clearly strong musicians. And clearly everything's good on that stage when they're playing. And so the group, again, is called Makeke. And then if anybody wants to follow the tour, which you must do, if they come to your town, just drop everything. Nothing else is more important than this. And
nice, thanks.
Bring your friends. It'll be a party. It'll be one of the best parties of the year. And you can go to Jane's website, which is Jane Bunnett. Is that correct? Yeah, Bunnett.
JaneBunnett.com. It's JaneBunnett, JaneBunnett.com.
Great.
And we'll have new information up, as I don't know if Jane mentioned, but we're next. The girls are heading back as of Monday, but our next hit is February. We're going to be at Friends University in Wichita, and I think we'll be in Denver, and we're going to be in Miami and other places in Florida. And then
the spring we're in Chicago and
yeah,
all
we're gonna
through
be
that area.
Yeah, we're going to be touring, and then in May we're going to be touring, and then in June we're going to be at the Washington, D.C. Jazz Festival and Saratoga and many more dates. And we're doing a Canadian tour in June and July. So I think you're going to hear a lot more about the group.
Great. And so there's ample opportunity for people almost anywhere in the country.
Yeah, we just found out the chart, the Jazz Week chart. We're hitting number 9 this week, so we've been moving up the chart. So we hope that's really connecting with people too. So we hope 2017 is a breakthrough for the band internationally.
Well, congratulations on that. That's great. So for more to follow this great band, Jane Bunnett, JaneBunnett.com, and that's where you can find out where they're playing, learn more about the band, learn about the different albums. And this is a group to enjoy and a group to go out and support, because they're not only doing what they're doing, but believe me, they're blazing a trail for other musicians. And that's a very important part of our whole tradition. So Larry and Jane, thank you so much for spending the time. Very excited to get to talk with you. Thanks for sharing your story and your
Thank you for just coming out of nowhere. We've always loved Jazz and Tuba, but discovering the group and actually coming to see it a few times and really, really getting what the band's about and the efforts. It's a labor of love for us, but music keeps you going. And that's what we do, and it's the joy of spending time with these women and just the lucky work that we've done with so many great Cuban musicians. It just keeps us young and keeps us moving.
Beautiful.
Thanks for your support.
Yeah, thank you for your support.
Oh, really, really glad to do it. So we've been speaking with Jane Bunnett and Larry Kramer. The group, again, is McKK. And go to janebunnett.com to find out more. This is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and I'll catch you next time.